This is The Book in the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
A group of slaves escapes from Egypt, wanders in the desert for 40 years, and in the process establishes the foundations for both the Jewish and Christian faiths. Seems like an unlikely story, right? Well, there really isn't much archaeology that directly supports the Exodus story, but Lipscomb University Egyptologist Mark Jansen says there is research by Kenneth Kitchen and others to support the idea that a child like Moses could have gotten an elite education in the court of the Pharaoh, as the Bible indicates, before he became the leader of this group.
Moses is sort of the perfect guy for this in a certain way because of his upbringing in the court of Pharaoh. Kitchen's done a lot of work on the structure of the covenant, and he's compared it to other ancient documents. And one of the main places that we see parallels to the covenant in Exodus is from the Hittites in the 14th, 13th century. They were in diplomatic relations with the Egyptians at the time. And so I think that's very interesting to just kind of note, like Moses might have been, this is very speculative at this point, but he might have been familiar with some of that as part of his upbringing, if the plan was on some level to use him like some of these other children of rulers. We can't know that for sure, but I think it actually fits better than it might seem at first glance. And every group needs a leader, right? Like someone's going to lead a group. And he's reluctant to as well, which is, I think, kind of interesting thematically.
So Moses potentially could have been raised as a candidate for, say, an ambassadorial position or potentially a vizier, another Canaanite from the land of Canaan who was raised in Pharaoh's court, became a vizier.
Yeah, there's no way to tell what they would have intended with him. The story doesn't give us enough details on that to begin with. We don't have Egyptian data on that either. By the way, Moses is a very generic name. Ramses is derivative of the same thing, at least in Egyptian. And there's a big debate whether it's Hebrew or Egyptian, but Ra Moses is the name for Ramses, which just means born of Ra. So like this isn't even a unique enough name to help us. Like if we did have Moses was here, I can imagine the reaction to that rather easily. Forgery, not that Moses, you know, yeah. Like you can see that people would be skeptical. So I think sometimes we have to always just rewind it and be like, there are claims of faith involved, but I think we can make it a reasonable faith. And this idea too, that kind of is the corollary to how could they have written all this, is how could Moses have been all these roles? Well, that's just the ancient world. To say no one person can fill all those roles is highly anachronistic. They absolutely fill all those roles, right? Moses belongs to a world of emperors and pharaohs and god kings who are prophet, priest, judge, general, you name it. So the idea that he's leading the people, that he's the communicator with the deity, of course, his brother's the actual priest, right? But these military, judicial, economic role, that's not unreasonable at all in the ancient world. That's just kind of how it was. Many examples anyway of it.
So we have an article that you wrote on the historicity of Moses that'll be in an upcoming issue of Artifacts, our Biblical Archaeology News magazine. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you were the editor of a book, The Five Views of the Exodus, mm-hmm. which came out several years ago, and I finally got through reading it just a few months ago. It was a very interesting presentation because the views differ quite a bit, different perspectives on the Exodus. I mean, a lot of mm-hmm. people say there's the late view and the early view, but there's more nuanced views than that. What has been the impact of this book? Do you think it has helped clarify the issues at all?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I hear from people occasionally that they enjoyed it and that they sided with one author or the other. And I wanted to write something that would allow interested lay people to get their feet wet on the debate that wasn't totally academic, though there's lots with the archaeology that can get very academic. What I was really wanting to do is combat the hokey blogs and vlogs that are out there, because for too many people, that's the first point of contact. And almost all of those way overstate everything or get very sensational, or you'll be watching one and for the last half of it, they don't interview experts anymore. And that's a tell, right? Because no one agrees with them at that point. The book came out, I think, into 21. Yeah, I think it's helping, and we're trying to get a discourse going. I think scholars aren't always particularly adept at getting the data to a general audience, which I'm trying to do there as well. It's funny, the book came out of this request I received that a guy was putting together for basically apologetics for campus ministry. He wanted me to read it over, and I said, man, you've got a lot to fix here. Like, this is it's not ready. You know, I was trying to be nice as I could. And so he calls me, right? This was just in emails initially. And he says, well, why isn't there a source on this that is more readable? You know, I'm a philosophy MA, like I'm educated, but I don't know where to get all the data. You know, I'm stumbling around. And I was like, you know what? I think we need to address that. So it kind of came out of that. But the other thing I wanted to note before we move on from that, but, you know, the whole debate of the date, right? We have the early, the late, late. If you're debating somebody about the date of the Exodus, they're already on your side on the more important topic, which is that there is an Exodus. The main debate is, let's try to establish the plausibility and the reasonableness of it. And then the date, yeah, that matters. As a scholar, I have strong views on that. But if someone disagrees with me, they already are on the same side on the whole bigger debate.
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on this, but my impression has been, as I've read and talked with people, that the early date of the Exodus kind of leans more heavily on a biblical chronology, and the late date leans a little more heavily on archaeology, although there's both in both perspectives, but that's just my...
I think that's mostly fair. I would push back in one little way. I would say the late date is the one that takes the data in the Pentateuch the most seriously, which I think is important as the context, whereas the early date relies on a reference in 1 Kings 6,
right,
which is tricky because large numbers of ancient people aren't as literal as modern people with numbers. That's how they reconcile the discrepancy between Kings and Exodus 1. So I think the late date, you know, we would say, no, we take the biblical data seriously as well. But both sides definitely have their sort of leaning.
For those who just joined us, we're talking with Mark Jansen, an Egyptologist and professor of archaeology at Lipscomb University. He is also deputy director of the Karnak Great Hypostyle Hall Project, which is an epigraphic mission at the Karnak Temple in Luxor, Egypt.
Tell it's a mouthful, right? So Karnak Temple is the largest ancient temple anywhere in the world. You can put Paris's Notre Dame inside of it four times over. The Hypostyle Hall is this forest of columns, basically decorated every square inch with ritual scenes and texts. So this is where pharaohs display their piety, right? Pharaohs always want to celebrate their valor and their piety. So that's sacred space for piety. There are 122 columns. Most of them are about 40 feet tall, and there are 12 that are 70 feet tall along the main column. So it's impressive. And if it had its roof intact, it would get as much press as the pyramids. Anybody listening should Google it. The pictures are incredible. On the exterior walls of that part of the temple, there are also battle scenes. So there's where Pharaoh celebrates his valor, because that's exterior walls, and so they put those kind of scenes there. Around the corner from the south part of the hall is the Cour de la Cachette, which is where they found dozens of complete statues and thousands of fragments back, you know, decades ago. And on the exterior of that wall, which runs right into the Hypostyle Hall, we have a very important wall which contains the peace treaty between Ramses and the Hittites, which is the first peace treaty between two actual empires. The other texts are just the empires bullying everybody. But this is two equal powers for the formal peace treaty. On each side of that text, we have battle scenes that I believe belong to Ramses' son and successor, Merneptah, who to your listeners might be famous for the so-called Israel Stela, which is the first extra-biblical mention of Israel. My role in the project is we're trying to put out the definitive scientific recordation of the wall in all its glory in the 2020s. So if anything happened to it down the road, or an earthquake or whatever, which has actually happened to Karnak in 1899, but if anything damaged the wall, we would have a one-to-one replica of it in two-dimension print and digital space online when we're all done. And then that can be used for anyone who wants to weigh in on Egyptian military and political history, or the debate about what Merneptah's doing and why he references Israel. Is that authentic? It's something that I think needs to be done, because scholars are just kind of doing their own thing at the wall, and they're not always that accurate because they can't see it well enough. And we're trying to put out the definitive scientific study of it. What we have is hundreds and hundreds of high def photographs with photogrammetry points, which then you can take those photos, run it in software that can cover any overlap. So like the photos are stitched together. it's surprisingly difficult to get a perfectly scientifically accurate photo, right? You can't have anything off in your angle or the lighting, is the two obvious things. But with so much overlap, the software, being smarter than us, can figure out exactly what it looks like, and then it creates what we call an orthophoto. The actual photo file size is 2 gigabytes, but that gives you an idea of the process and how many photos are actually stitched together to make it. It takes the computer like all night. We had to redo it like 3 times because it kept crashing. We can run photogrammetry and get detailed down to hundredths of a millimeter. And we can also tweak the lighting and do different things to try to see if lines will stand out. And you say, okay, that's actually a carved line. We thought it was damaged. So yeah, there's a lot that technology is changing with the process. It's pretty great.
How many pharaohs are represented in the records at the Karnak Temple?
Oh gosh, if you do the whole temple, dozens. The wall I'm on would be just Ramses, the treaty, and a Bando text, like a border text that goes at the top of the wall, his son Merneptah. And then what we think happened was Merneptah's son Seti put his name over Merneptah's name after a usurper erased Merneptah's name. Our wall has an interesting bit of detective work to do to figure out, you know, who done it, why there's damage where it is. They often will try to steal each other's monuments. Within the hypostyle hall, you then have Seti the First, Ramses the Second. Pretty much all the Ramessides are trying to claim a little slice of that pie, which is very difficult because the big, powerful, famous pharaohs, Seti and Ramses the Second, have already taken most of the good real estate. And you don't want to mess with them. That's real bad form.
So how much time are you spending in the field? Do you most of your work remotely back in the office?
Yeah, so we try to be in the field 2 out of every 3 years for 3-ish weeks at a time to basically collate what we've been working on back in the office. So we're doing the drawings digitally now, right, of the battle scenes and of the glyphs, which is, of course, a no-brainer since you can easily tweak it and erase it without having to start over, right? And you just save the file, you know, brand new every time. So it's a hybrid process now, but you do have to still be in the field. There's no replacing physical observation on the wall, even with the best photos. Sometimes something stands out, or you take a mirror and you change the way the light hits the wall, and all of a sudden you realize what's actually there. But we don't have to be there year round or anything crazy or for too long at a time.
Well, thanks to Professor Mark Jansen, an Egyptologist and professor of archaeology at Lipscomb University, for filling us in on the historicity of Moses and some perspectives on the Exodus and his own research in Egyptology. He is also a participant in another podcast about biblical archaeology. It's called On Script, The Biblical World. We have a link to that on our website. Also a link to the book, 5 Views of the Exodus, which you would recommend for more information on helping to understand this one particular biblical controversy. We'd like to remind you that we also have a website, radioscribe.com, that has information on our quarterly biblical archaeology news magazine, Artifacts, and information on our next trip to Israel in November of 2024. You can find out more information on that and see some fascinating archaeology videos that we've been featuring recently at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier. Join us again next time for more Backgrounders on the Bible through biblical archaeology on The Book and the Spade.
The Book and the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on biblical archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.